Hi, well, thank you for coming to this panel. Sunday morning, after a heavy night, after a heavy whole crime fest. I think it's been wonderful. Fantastic writers, and here we've got more fantastic writers. I'm Janet Lawrence. I'm chair. Actually, I hate chair. How fancy being a piece of furniture. I am chairman of the judging panel for the Ellis Peters Historical Crime Award. You all know Ellis Peters, the creator of Brother Cadfael, and all those wonderful, I mean, they are so good, those books. She was writing at a time when historical crime fiction was really at its very start. And the award has been set up in her memory to find the best historical crime novel of the year. We five judges read anything from 50 to 60 historical crime novels to choose our shortlist. So when we get our shortlist, they are the very, very best historical crime novelists. And here we have four writers of the very, very best, the shortlisted crime writers. The title of this panel is A Moment in Time, and I think we all know L.P. Hartley's phrase, the past is a foreign country, they do things differently there. And so what I hope we're going to discover in the next hour is how different historical crime fiction is from contemporary crime fiction, and how each of these writers achieves a really successful historical crime novel. And I'm going to introduce each of them in turn. I'll start with Andrew Martin. It's always difficult when you have a name as a surname, which can also be a Christian name.
I work for George Michael.
Andrew, you have a railway detective, which I think is unique in historical crime fiction. What put you onto the fact that there was such a thing in the early 20th century, and where did your character Jim Stringer and his wife Lydia come from? And where did you get your encyclopedic knowledge of the railways at that time?
Well, my dad worked on the railways, so I was brought up with it, really. As for why I knew there were railway policemen, in Edwardian times there was railway everything. Railway amateur drama societies, railway rifle shooting clubs, railway pubs, railway holiday clubs, railway vicars. So, of course, there were railway police as well. And I once saw a picture of the railway police on parade outside their office at York Station. They would parade about once a year, very reluctantly, but they could do it. And I think that's what initially put me onto it. What was your other question? That's how I knew they were railway police.
Right. And where did your character, Jim Stringer, and his wife, Lydia, come from?
The first book in the series was called The Necropolis Railway, which is about a railway line that carries dead bodies down to what was then the biggest cemetery in the British Empire, Brookwood in Surrey. And my idea was to have a young man recruited to work on that line who initially didn't know what it was doing and just thought he was getting a good job on the railways. So he had to be quite naive and gauche. He also had to be a train spotter, because I wanted him to be enthusiastic about the railways. And it wasn't so unusual to be... there was something wrong with you in those days if you were a young man and you were not interested in railways. They were called train watchers. Lots of them were vicars, educated people. So therefore that dictated his character. And then when he got married and eventually met a woman, I wanted her to be a bit more intelligent than he is, so that she could point out all his follies and expose his naivety. And I also wanted someone who didn't like railways, so that she could say his interest in them was slightly misplaced.
Thank you, Andrew. Go on to Marjorie. Marjorie Eccles has written a very successful series of contemporary crime novels featuring Superintendent Gil Mayo, and his assistant, Inspector Abigail Moon, been on the television. So why did you switch to writing historical standalone crime novels? And what made you choose the first half of the 20th century?
Well, I thought it would be easier. That's the main thing, really. I've got a bit... nowadays, crime, the crime fiction scene, it's got so technical. Got so very technical. And I thought all this DNA stuff and all the rest of it, you know, they wouldn't have that. And that was one of the reasons. Of course, that is a sort of two-edged sword, because you don't know exactly... how much they did know in those days. Fingerprinting and that sort of thing, fair enough. But, you know, how far advanced they were and so on. So that made it rather difficult. But why did I choose the time? It said my period is Edwardian, which, of course, is really, if we're being strictly honest, it's... 1901, when Victoria died, to 1910, when Edward himself died. But it stretches a little bit further than that. It really goes to when he was in his heyday, when Edward was in his heyday, as it were, with all these women and all the rest of it, and all the glamorous things that happened at the end of the 19th century, and right up to the First World War. That was when it was. But I suppose it helped because I'm practically an Edwardian myself anyway, so that's why.
Right. Roger Morris. Many writers would have fought shy of following in the footsteps of Dostoevsky, yet you have resurrected Porfiry Petrovich, his detective in Crime and Punishment, and have written three novels featuring him as your protagonist. Did this take chutzpah or only a passion for 19th century Tsarist Russia?
I think it was naivety, really, that I didn't. It's kind of like sometimes you're the victim of your ideas. I had the idea to do it, and so I thought, well, I'll give it a go, and without really thinking too much about how it would be received by the kind of Dostoevsky purists and the people who consider it to be their job to kind of police everything to do with Dostoevsky. I mean, it came, I suppose, I first read Crime and Punishment, which is where Porfiry Petrovich comes from, when I was probably a little bit too young to read it as a sort of precocious teenager. And I did enjoy the kind of axe murder in it, and I wasn't too... the sort of philosophical and religious aspects of the book were a little bit over my head at the time, but I remember reading, it was a sort of Penguin Classics, and they'd billed it as one of the earliest detective novels, so I thought that the kind of mixture of a sort of Russian kind of grand Russian sort of book with a good detective story would be a perfect read, because I suppose I was reading a lot of things like Sherlock Holmes and watching Sexton Blake on the telly at the time so that appealed to me. But actually, it's not really a detective novel, because it's more about the crime, and it's the story of the criminal. So what I thought would be quite interesting would be to write the book that blurb had sort of promised, and which would be to take Porfiry Petrovich and to put him at the center of his own kind of sleuthing yarns. So that was the idea I had, and I didn't do anything about it for years and years and years, because I sort of thought, no, you can't do that. And then when I'd written all the other ideas I had, I thought, well, I better write that one now. So that's what I did.
And so we come to Anne Granger. You're another author with not only one but two successful series of contemporary crime novels, and I gather you're just starting on a third one, but today we're looking at historical. Your Mitchell and Markby novels are rural, but the Fran Varady ones are an urban series featuring a deprived girl coping with the underside of life. Now you have embarked on the series set in the mid-Victorian age, featuring a girl with few advantages trying to make her way in the world. Do the parallels between the two girls, Lizzie and Fran, extend beyond this, or does the historical viewpoint mean you see Lizzie's situation as very different from Fran's?
Yes, Lizzie's situation is very different. I didn't realize when I started just how different it was going to turn out to be. And one of the things that happened was that I wrote two books with her working as a companion to her aunt.
This is Lizzie.
Lizzie,
yes.
The character in the Victorian story. And then I discovered when I sat down to write the third one that I had a big problem in that, of course, as a single woman and one dependent entirely on her aunt taking her in and giving her this job, she doesn't have any independence of action. She doesn't have much free time. She doesn't really have the opportunity to spend much time with the man in her life who is the detective, Ben Ross, the detective who is actually the police presence in the story. So in book three, I'm afraid I've married them off. because actually, that was the only... I tried to write it with them both still single, and there were so many problems that I had to actually marry them off in order to give her space of her own, because Victorian women, until they married, very much did not have space of their own. They were either with their families or with someone on whom they were dependent, and you know, an employer, but they didn't go out on their own. So I'm afraid I've had to marry them.
Reader, I married him.
Yeah.
Readers, I married them. You raise a very interesting point there, because characters in historical crime novels, we always are told that human nature does not change, that a character in the medieval times has basically the same character as the people we see around us today. But the settings, the periods that they live in, must affect the way that their characters develop and how they behave. You've just given us an example of that, Anne. How about you, Andrew? Do you find that your Lydia Jim Stringer.
Yes, I think he comes up against the class system in a big way, which was of course a bigger thing in it, although it's by no means gone away, even though we're constantly reassured that it is.
Doesn't exist anymore.
It doesn't exist anymore, but that's nonsense. But it was very much in evidence in Edwardian times. And I still have a northern accent, and when there's certain types of people that I meet who speak in a way that I find intimidating because it's so correct. And then I sort of go red and get tongue-tied. And Jim has a lot of that. And in his sort of investigations, he will inevitably come up against people who will either accidentally or deliberately intimidate him. I'm also interested in the physicality of the world, the Edwardian world. For example, half of my plots couldn't happen if Jim had a mobile phone. And quite often, he wants to get a message to someone urgently. He's got to walk to the post office. He's got to have 2 shillings or whatever it costs to send a telegram. He's got to know the telegraphic address of the person he wants to contact. He's got to write it all out. He spends a lot of time exhausted, Jim Stringer. He does a lot of walking. And I think that is... I like describing physical business. I like having somebody on a train for a long time and being tired and going to sleep and then walking 3 miles through the rain just to get back home again. Interminable cycle rides against the wind. You know, I like the idea of a pre-electronic age and a sort of little man battling not only society but the physical elements as well. So there are two things that I think were very different about his world. Another thing, just very quickly, is the lack of PC. I don't particularly have an axe to grind against political correctness, but the lack of it in those days was absolutely fascinating. You know, somebody sent me the other day a little notice that used to appear on Northeastern Railway trains. It's directed at chimney sweeps. It said something like, "Sweeps, since your habitual garb is so filthy, would you kindly refrain from sitting on our seats because you are not welcome to do so. Stand at the end of the corridors." I mean, you've just got to extrapolate back from that thing. What kind of world was this where they could say that? And the way that men working on the tracks did not wear high visibility vests. You know, they wore a suit. Men wore a suit to do any man digging a hole in the road wore a suit. There wasn't the same value put on life. You know, it was much more of a lottery. And I think a more physically dangerous and more physically exciting and more physically interesting world as well. And I don't get me on. towns and how every town in those days was different from every other town. How could you write a novel set in a town? What, two characters, a modern novel, they go to a McDonald's and have a coffee. What do you say? Do you describe the McDonald's or do you just take it as read that everybody knows what it's like? I think the urban environment was also much more fascinating.
Of course, urban environment. You're, Roger, you're very involved with this, aren't you? You have marvellous descriptions of St. Petersburg and how incredibly rough and raw it is so much of the time.
Thank you. Yes. I mean, a lot of that... what I wanted to do was create stories and characters that came very much from the setting and the period, and that rather than just taking kind of abstract crime ideas and putting them in a setting, it had to come out of that. So I think that a sense of the place and the period was very important. And a lot of where I went to for my research was, you know, the novels of Dostoevsky and that. The way I saw it sometimes was... it was almost like there was a kind of artist studio, and there was a palette with colours laid out on it and an easel, and he'd sort of vacated the studio and I walked in and picked up his palette and did my own daubing. So because I think it is an imaginative thing, because I, you know, obviously I can go to St. Petersburg now, but I can't go to St. Petersburg in the middle of the 19th century, so you can only you can do that by reading around the period and reading novels of the period. But ultimately, to create a story and bring it to life, I think it's at that sort of magical moment where the imagination takes off, and you almost have to do your research and then put it behind you and hope that enough of it has entered you to have those that texture at your fingertips without sort of straining for it. So I think it's a kind of, I'm not quite sure how it's done, but it just seems to be a sort of an instinctive thing to get the setting and the characters. But I mean, the czarist, what I do find fascinating is the idea of a decent man, a just man, kind of working for an unjust regime. So that kind of political aspect was something that I found interesting, I think, as well, which was unique to that period.
Marjorie, your novel, A Nocturne in Time, and also your, I think it was the first of your historical crime series, A Shape of Sand?
Shape of Sand. Yes.
They're very much involved with middle class, upper middle class, rather than the lower classes.
They were, yes.
Do you find that has its own differences from our own time?
Certainly it had. But I hope not to continue doing that, but I think that brings the flavour out of the Edwardian times, if you concerned with that. But you were saying about that human nature doesn't change, and certainly it doesn't, but I do think that the circumstances that people find themselves in do impinge upon that and alter how they behave, particularly in the period that we're talking about. It was a very exuberant period. New things were happening all the time, cars, telephones, aeroplanes, particularly in the status of women. They were throwing off their corsets, metaphorically as well as literally. And that interests me, how women were treated and how they emerged from the circumstances of that had surrounded them in Victorian times. They were becoming freer in every way. And
I always think it's rather interesting. The flappers threw off their corsets. What was it, 40 years later, their female descendants burned their bras?
Yes, that's true. But yes, I suppose so. But incidentally, I mean, that was when bras were first came into their own, actually, just as women were throwing off the corsets. They were actually embracing the bra. And I think it's probably the last thing that most women would do would be to burn their bras. Probably
but
the
nowadays,
first thing they pick up in the case of fire. But,
I was only going to say, and 40 years sort of or more later still, women do an awful lot of going to the gym and running and keeping fit, trying to keep their figures.
Yes.
Well, they didn't try and keep their figures in years gone by. They simply laced them in and padded them out. And
One thing that struck me looking at the Mitchell and Kenyon archive films of Edwardian life was how thin everybody was. And how physically elegant people were.
Look at the exercise they took.
Yeah, but when you look close, of course, they might not have had teeth, or they might have had black teeth, but all the men carried off the suit very well, you know.
Yes,
it's interesting how they, during the Boer War and the First World War, which is the book that I've just finished, how many men were actually rejected because of their bad health.
Yes.
They had dreadful teeth, they had tuberculosis, and so on and so on.
But rejected, particularly in the Boer War recruitment, wasn't it?
Yes.
Wasn't it a bit better by the time the first...
I think they still did. They were just not physically fit enough to fight, even though they were so short of men,
Well, the NHS has a lot to commend it, doesn't it? Because that has meant that all of our teeth are in much better shape. And our bodies are, too, because we don't have to try and find money. Plots. What about the crimes in your novels? Do they reflect the times that they're committed in? Do you look in for a period crime to feature in your novels? What about you, Anne?
Well, I suppose the historical ones, yes, they do reflect this peculiar situation that single women were in, because they were extremely vulnerable if they did not have families to look after them. They were at the mercy of any employer or any dodgy character they came across. And in both of the two books, A Rare Interest in Corpses, where it's a lady's companion who's come to grief, and in A Mortal Curiosity, where it's a girl in good family, but whose husband has left her, and that's a great scandal, and who is there pretty well at the mercy of her family in whatever they choose to do with her. So I think that certainly the books do reflect, you know, a contemporary issue in that time. But I think, and I know Andrew has already touched on this, their attitudes were different. And although human nature perhaps doesn't change, it's quite important not to give a modern attitude to something to someone who lived 150 years ago and perhaps didn't see things in quite the same way. They may have seen things as regrettable. For example, people did not live so long. There was a high rate of infant mortality. If you did not have any money, you risked ending up in the workhouse. That was regrettable in their eyes, but it didn't shock them perhaps in the way it would shock us, because that was how life was. And they knew that was how life was. So I think you have to be a little bit careful as a writer not to make them sort of too horrified by something that they might have thought was a very sad state of affairs, but they thought couldn't be changed.
Roger, how far... Do you go to Dostoevsky for your crimes, or do you go to other sources?
I think I perhaps jumped the gun a bit earlier, because... but I think the thing that has changed... as well in terms of moral attitudes and sexual behavior in modern day, and that sort of it's almost like the boundaries of transgression have moved, so that the things that people might have tried to hush up in the past, you know, sort of suppress, and the whole notion of what would be a shameful thing to do that might not actually be a crime, or actually, I mean, for instance, in the case of homosexuality, was criminal in certain periods, and certainly in Russia at the time I was writing, and until relatively recently over here. And so you get kind of plots that come off things like that in terms of either directly blackmail or trying to... The hypocrisy that that kind of a Victorian sort of public persona of someone who's respectable produces, I think that's a kind of quite a rich area for potential crimes that is possibly missing now, because people, you know, the bounds of the, what is a, you know, sort of permissive behaviour has changed. So, but I think that's one possible line of things. But I think also I like to sort of try and have the, rather than sort of taking the crimes coming out of specific Dostoevskian stories, it's more from the ideas, the intellectual climate, and the sort of moral climate of the time somehow. So
and the characters, Marjorie, status plays a great part in a number of your books, doesn't
what
it?
Does that
status, the status of the characters affects the way they behave and gives rise to crimes for the protection of status.
Yes. Well, I mean, you can't blackmail anybody now about anything, can you? You know, and that's a thing that, as you've touched on, this was something that that could happen in that way.
Yeah.
Yes, certainly.
So, Andrew, have you used blackmail in any of yours?
No, I think. I can't remember.
I don't remember. No, I can't.
But I think that the point that I would like to make about crime is I read that there were only about 4 murders committed on the railways between about 1860 and 1914. Well, there's already been way more than 4 in my... I think that the infrequency of murder was something that I found out about and was quite surprised by. In York, my native city, there was one murder between 1902 and 1908 or something. But I think the point is that there was the same fear of bad behaviour on the street as there is now. And there's a book called The History of Respectable Fears, which is by a historian, I can't remember his name, but he points out that Victorians and Edwardians were scared of hoodies and youths on the street just as we are today. The particular bugbear at late Victorian times was the chap in narrow go-wide trousers, flares. And he, someone who was playing a mouth organ on the street corner, that was considered very sinister. I mean, it's rather charming today, isn't it? But they would beat you up, you know. It was quite. There were parts of York, a fairly respectable city, although quite a significant working class population. Police didn't go there, or they went there in twos and threes and never on their own. So I think the level of casual violence and physical intimidation on the street was probably higher than it is today. And I think it's important to put that in a historical novel, because the danger with historical novels is that people think it's a chocolate box. It's cute and cosy. And I think if you've got people swearing, that's good in historical, because they did swear. And people complain to me a bit. They say, your characters do a lot of swearing, don't they? But when do these people think that swearing began? You know, 1976? I've read accounts of criminal confessions written in Edwardian times, and the crooks are writing out what they did in the hope of getting a reduction in their prison sentence, and they're saying things like, I told him, give him the F gun, you F idiot. It's not written out in full, but it's clear that they were swearing all the time. Working class men. I think working class men swore just as much then as they do now. And it's important because that shocks the reader. They think, yes, this is not, in my case, it's not Thomas the Tank Engine. You know?
It's true. There was so much violence because you could go out, you could buy a gun anywhere.
Everyone had a gun, respectable men had guns.
You could go in Selfridges and order a gun for the county.
It's like the Wild West.
Whatever you wanted to buy.
Not only the Wild West, anywhere in America today, or practically anywhere in America today.
Yes.
And you could acquire poison very easily too.
Yeah,
you know, it's very, very handy. Yes, and of course, nearly every house, certainly in the middle of the century, had arsenic because it was the standard thing you put down for rats.
Yes,
and everybody had rats and mice.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And there are gruesome tales of babies attacked in their cradles and so on by rats, which was quite common.
Yeah,
and then you sent for the rat catcher, who was a very familiar figure.
Yes, cutthroat razors.
Cutthroat razors, gosh, it was ever so easy to kill someone. and now when we try and do it, we scratch our heads and we think he couldn't get hold of the poison and he couldn't get hold of the gun. And health and safety would have stopped him doing something else. It's got harder.
Nothing is ever easy. Andrew, you raised an important point about dialogue. Where do you all go to research a period dialogue, and how faithful are you to it in your novels? Roger, what about you?
Well, I suppose I'm slightly different in that my books are set in Russia, so the original characters would have been speaking Russian, so I have to imagine myself writing a translation of a book that was never written. So I try and make the language, the dialogue sort of appear natural and not overdo kind of archaisms, but not try and put in any sort of noticeably anachronistic modern touches. It's just kind of trying to get it so that it's pacey and interesting dialogue and people don't find themselves worrying about that aspect of it in a way, I think. But I think possibly because of, you know, it's a slightly unusual situation because I'm not trying to recreate a sort of a style of English that was spoken at a particular time, so in some ways I kind of sidestepped that issue, I think, possibly.
Well, I don't know, because if you wrote it as, let's say, Ed McBain might write it, then that would strike me.
Yes,
a very
I mean,
it,
no,
note.
True. I think people are. I think possibly one thing that I learned that's quite interesting is that there's been a lot of problems with. Understanding between Russian and English people. There's a lot of Russians now working in business over here, and they speak very good English, but they don't speak. What they don't do is they don't do the niceties of it. Russian is a very much more brusque and abrupt language, and people just, rather than saying, there's been a lot of misunderstandings because people go, would it be at all possible for you to get that document ready? And it's like, no. It wouldn't be possible. They don't even explain. They just give no. So because they're used to people saying, "I want you to photocopy that document now." You know, just telling directly what you want someone to do, rather than sort of doing the very English kind of way of speaking. I think possibly because I am English, my Russian characters are probably a little bit more polite than genuine Russians would be. But I have tried to make them brusque, but then sometimes I think it would just appear sort of slightly, you know, rude to an English reader, and they would then take that Porfiry was perhaps an unpleasant, rude character rather than the fact that that's just the way that Russian people sort of go on. But I think I do try and think, well, don't overdo the niceties, just sort of try and make it a little bit more brusque to capture that.
What about you, Marjorie? How do you cope with dialogue?
My grandparents were Edwardians, and I remember how they spoke and how they acted and what their values were, and I can always hear them speaking as I'm writing. I don't go in for this gadzookery anyway, as I call it, for historical writing. I think if you just write plainly, in plain speech, that's the thing. And writing at the moment, I'm doing a novel set in my native Yorkshire, and it's lovely because I can use all the expressions that came to me as a child. I mean, not ebi gormino, but all the natural rhythms of the speech there, and I'm finding that very, very good. That won't have changed at all. I mean, it certainly hasn't in my experience.
Andrew, you started us on this with your F word in records. Where else do you go for your dialogue research?
Well, if you read contemporary novels written at that time, then it's full of them. And Arnold Bennett is a good source because he has a lot of demotic, not only a brilliant novelist, I think, but full of demotic speech. And there are a few expressions that recur in his books. One is, that's all about it. So the Edwardians would say, I was too tired and that's all about it, meaning that's the end of the story. That was a very common expression. Another one is, I kept silence, meaning I thought it best not to say, I shut up and didn't say anything. I've never heard anybody say in modern life the first one of those two, that's all about it. But I was at a party the other day, actually, and I heard a woman say, I kept silence. and it was like seeing a ghost, because that is the only time I've heard that expression in my lifetime.
Did you find out who she was and why she'd said it?
Well, it turned out that I knew her, actually. She's called Annabelle Freiberg. She is, I suppose, a bit old-fashioned. It's uncanny when you another thing is when people say, "I dare say." I think that's quite characteristically Edwardian. You hear that a bit. And if I see somebody who, or overhear somebody in a public place talking in that way, I'll sidle up to them. See if I can get some more.
I'm glad you listen to people, because I'm always doing it. I listen and watch people. I think writers should do that. They need their eyes and their ears. Mm. But my husband gets very embarrassed and says, "Stop it, you're doing it again."
Well, yes.
What about Victorian speech, Anne? What about Victorian dialogue?
Well, I think, as Marjorie says, I think the rhythm of the speech is one of the things that you can hope to get. Obviously, you try and make it a kind of thing that modern readers can identify with, but at the same time, you have to watch out, because you can end up speaking in a... They were rather more precise in the way they spoke. And actually, my father used to say, "And that's all about it." And then you didn't argue with him anymore.
The thing about that phrase, it's rather a mouthful, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And I think that they were more orotund. They were more willing to spend time talking.
Have you read the letters that soldiers wrote home? I'm talking about quite simple men who perhaps didn't have a lot of education. But if you look at what they actually put in their letters, and actually their handwriting...
And handwriting's always beautiful.
Their handwriting is wonderful. I think perhaps their education, for all that they left school at about 10, their education has something that ours lacks.
Yes, I agree. Mm.
What about research as a general topic? How much of it goes into your books and how much of it gets left out?
It's like an iceberg, isn't it, really? You know,
That's a nice simile.
You know, you leave out most of what you research, and it's just the tip of it showing, really. Hopefully it's under there and it underpins it. You know, you have to do as much research as you can. Mm. But I think there is a danger that you can research too much, in actual fact, and you lose the spontaneity then in your work.
Does anybody find the danger of liking the research so much they put off actually writing the book?
Oh, yes.
Get sidetracked. Yes.
It is a catch-all excuse for anything. You could be caught trespassing, and you say, "I'm researching a novel."
I think there are two kinds of research that I sort of do, which is the general research at the beginning of writing, where you're just trying to get some, you know, I think even though I'm writing books set in the same period, you still want to enrich your general background knowledge, and something new may turn up that will help. But then there's another thing, which is you're writing a story and you suddenly come to something that you need to know how something was done or what something might have looked like or what, you know, and so that you have to go and look specifically for, you know, description of a piece of machinery or something that was in use. And then you may find that all out and then think, well, actually it doesn't belong in the book anyhow, but I just feel a lot better knowing that to write the scene that doesn't include it.
You'll use it in another book.
Maybe, yes.
Yes. You've got to be careful about using the internet as well, because anybody can put anything on.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
I wanted to know something about the uniform of the Fleet Air on during the Second World War, in actual fact, and I looked it up on the internet and printed it out. And my husband came and he looked at it and he said, "Where'd you get this?" So I told him, and he said, "It's rubbish." And he knew that was the uniform, and it was someone, actually, I think it was an American who'd written it, and it was British Fleet Air on, and the uniform was completely wrong.
I have
should have asked your husband in the first place.
I have been in the first place, yes, yeah. Of course, yes.
I have the Fleet Air on Museum just a few miles from me,
yes.
And it's wonderful. Come down and stay with me, and you can go to the Fleet Air on Museum. It's really good. I mean, have any of you come across particular gems that you suddenly has opened up your eyes to a whole new area that you can take your books into? I'm sorry, I flung this at them. I didn't warn them at all. No, well, we'll pass swiftly on.
I inherited the family photograph album, and inside was a folded sheet of newsprint, and I opened it, and suddenly my mind went right back to what I had been told as a child. It was the day of the relief of Mafeking, and my grandmother, when she was a child, was orphaned at a very tender age. She was about 10, I think, and she went to live with a family, friends, and they had a daughter who was the same age that she was, and they were woolen manufacturers, and when she grew up, she married the son of another woolen manufacturer who'd gone out to South Africa and become what was known as an interior trader there. He used to send things back and so on and so on. And she married him, and he subsequently became the mayor of Mafeking at the time of the siege.
Oh,
and so I thought, and I remembered hearing all about this, about Sarah and what she'd done and all the rest of it then. Never thought about it till that time. So I wrote a short story about it, and it eventually became a book.
That's right, yes. It was your last year's book, wasn't it?
It was...
The book that was published last... not last... Where am I?
It was the second book.
Yes,
the second,
that's right, 2007.
Yes, it was Shadows and Light.
Shadows, yeah.
Yes, yes.
So suddenly, opening a photo album gives you a whole book.
Absolutely, yes, yes.
A sort of lesser thing, but I was in the book that I've just written, which... I wanted a scene between Porphyry and his kind of sidekick, Virginsky, where they would go for something to eat and perhaps get drunk and just sort of towards the end of the thing as a kind of release. So I was looking for a restaurant to sort of set this in, and I've got a Baedeker's of St. Petersburg period, and it lists restaurants and gives you a sort of how much it would have cost to eat there and what sort of meal you could expect to have. And there was one that was a little note saying with a billiard hall, so I thought that was quite nice because I could have them going for a game of billiards, and then I had to find out what sort of billiards would be played in St. Petersburg at that time. But it was a restaurant called the Domenica, and I didn't know this, but there's a massive 5-volume biography of Dostoevsky that I'm sort of slowly working my way through, and soon after I was reading a bit about his life at a particular period, and when he was hard up for cash, and he used to go to the Domenica to play billiards for money. He used to gamble, and so
really?
It's kind of like I thought, well, it's got to go in now because he used to go there himself, and at a particular time when he was hard up, he was actually making his living playing billiards, basically supporting his writing in that way.
Yeah, I think Baedeker guides are wonderful, and I've got one for the 1890s, which is Austria and southern Germany. But of course, Austria goes down as far as Bosnia and parts of Italy and all over the place. And you have this extraordinary realization that the Book of Vienna, for example, was Austrian. And they celebrated it being Austrian for 100 years. They had special festivities. And there were people living there who never left their villages, who were born as Austrian citizens and lived and were buried in what was Austrian territory. And I think the actual realization of how much, not just that the map has changed, that people's perceptions of who they were have changed. You didn't realize who you were half the time. Yeah. They do. I know there's any Ukrainians present. They will be perhaps argue with me, but it has been said that it was not until somebody in the Ukraine published a grammar of the Ukrainian language that many Ukrainians realized that they had a language. They all thought they spoke a dialect of Russian, and it gave the nationalist sort of movement a terrific, boost.
Just one more question before we throw it open to the question and answer sessions. All of you create the most marvellous living characters. They come over so strongly, and as in all the best books, they drive the plot forward. Can any of you identify where your characters have come from? Marjorie, what about you? Grow within you.
No, I don't know. They just arrive somehow, don't they? Really, it's is God-given, I think. You know, when you suddenly see a character and then they begin to grow, and then around them other characters grow, and so on and so on. At least that's how it is to me. Perhaps, you know, just a rather woolly way of going on, but that's how it happens.
Andrew?
I don't know either. I think that a lot of character arises from the physical situation of the character. So if you have a man, imagine a man riding a bike, he's going to be a different sort of man to a man driving a big fancy car. So I've got a working class character, young, pretty clever, decent, dogged, does ride a bike. Then you begin to imagine him, and then it's not, I don't think you can start with a psychological mindset and say, I've got a character who's neurotic in this way, because that's putting the cart before the horse. I think that start with the practicalities.
Right.
And then you will find, and then you begin to put them into situations, which again there is a physical situation, and then they've got to make choices. If he's challenged to play billiards for money, does he say yes or no? You've got to decide. If he says yes, then you're stuck with that decision for the rest of that character's life. He's the kind of person who would take up that offer. So that's factored in. And you go on like that. You know, if he gets to the station and he wants to get to a village outlying, does he take a cab or does he walk? Again, it's a what kind of person is he? And if you give him a whole set of physical challenges, then he will respond one way or the other. It's like a mouse in a laboratory, you know.
Roger, do you have mice in your laboratory?
Well, again, I suppose the thing that worried me taking a character from someone else's book, although in many ways I suppose you can say, well, there's your character, you've just taken it, but Porphyry is only in Crime and Punishment, I think, directly for two chapters, and he sort of casts his shadow over the rest of the book because Raskolnikov is kind of obsessed by him. But what I was constantly worried about was that the sort of purists were going to say that I'd got Porphyry Petrovich totally wrong and that he wasn't like that. And that, because actually what I couldn't write a list of the attributes that Dostoevsky gave him and then sort of make my character, you know, make sure that I went back to that checklist and always had him doing something like that. I had to sort of just, it was almost as if I'd encountered someone in life and then used them as a model to create my own character, so that my Porphyry Petrovich is mine, not Dostoevsky's. So he had to kind of move on and be, you know, have a kind of different life. So I think, you get bits from within yourself, I suppose, that even though when you're writing about characters in a far-off city at a different time, in some ways, you know, there's elements of autobiography, and because you've done those things, but because you draw on parts of it. You can't, inevitably, I think you have to shape your characters out of your own understanding of human nature, so there's something of myself, I suppose, that goes into it.
Anne, how about you, very quickly? Where does Lizzie come from?
I think a little bit like Marjorie, I think the characters do seem to grow. When I finished the Fran Variety books, I thought, what would it be? I did think, what would it be like if a girl was like Fran lived in an earlier period in the middle of the 19th century? And I realised that she couldn't have lived in any way as she did in the modern stories. She just couldn't do it.
So which brings us back to almost where we started, that the period does affect the character. Mm. Right, questions? Yes.
Do you ever feel you have a need to go into a physical environment, either in Russia or in England itself, to refresh your own memory of what your environment you're writing about looks like? Are there places you go to in London or elsewhere that says, this is what I'm talking about? Because you still have it. We don't have it in California. But you still have your past. And our past is our future. And I just wondered whether there are places you go to.
Definitely.
And where are they?
Well, for example, with the Necropolis Railway, which is a novel I set to do with this line that carried dead bodies from London down to Surrey, there is a thing called the Necropolis Station. It still survives, and if you're coming out of Waterloo Station and look to the left, it looks exactly as you'd expect it to look, a Gothic, gloomy building, and it's now owned by a Greek shipping company. And I went to look at it, knowing I was going to set a novel around this little railway station for the dead, and a Greek shipping magnate came out of the office and said, "Would you like to look inside?" It was all exactly as I'd sort of dreamed it would be, you know, so that was perfect. And that kind of thing, it's immensely important to go to places. It's much better than sitting in a library.
Right.
And as you pointed out, the great advantage of, one of the few great advantages of being British. Well, many aren't there. But that's dead right.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. I've never written anything about anywhere I haven't been, except when I was doing my South African book. And I wanted to go to Mafeking. And we had the idea that we would go Cape Town to Cairo, the railway, do all that, you know, wonderful, which goes right through Mafeking, which was a very important centre, railway centre, at that particular time. But, of course, it now goes through Zimbabwe. So, I mean, that was a no-no, wasn't it, for a start? You know, we said, right, we can't do that. Go to Johannesburg. Johannesburg is not a very nice place for tourists, apparently. And then it's a nothing of a journey into Mafeking. So we didn't actually go in the end. And then when the book was finished, I read and read and read about it. That was as much as I could do. And my editor happened to be South African. So I thought, oh, God, you know, I'm going to be in trouble here. But in actual fact, she could find nothing wrong with it. So that was all right. But no, I must go to places to find out about them.
Any more questions?
Yes. Do you ever find details, things that you can't use because people wouldn't believe it at the period? Suppose you discover, as an imaginary example, that Wayne was a popular name in the 19th century, but if you used it, people would think this person doesn't know what they're talking about. Does it ever happen to you? Constrained by people's view of your period.
All my writing life, I've had letters from people telling me I've got things wrong. and I've had lots of letters from judges who criticise my court procedure. And a gentleman who used to write to me and correct my Latin. I'm sure that if you did something like that, they would write to you at once. Once or twice I've written back and said, "No, you're wrong."
Edwardian men might call their girlfriends baby. And I put that in once. And, I never had a response, but I know some people wouldn't have believed that. They would have thought that was an anachronism.
I had the same thing when I was writing about Egypt, about going up the canal. And they had this boat equipped with a refrigerator. And they called it a refrigerator. And sometimes they called it a fridge in the actual handbook. But could you say that? And we compromised in the end, and we called it an icebox, with the consultation of my editor. But in actual fact, they did call them fridges in those days.
There's a question there.
Yes, is there a common view on the date when historicals become modern crime fiction?
1950s is the cut-off.
Yes, it's at the moment it's 1970. I'll tell you why. I was in on drawing up the as it was called at the time, the rubric for this award, and we decided that history started a generation back, and a generation is 30 years. And when we 30. Anyway, that's what we said, and it's before 1970. I can remember children researching the Second World War, which I lived through as history in school, and I think, oh God, now I'm old. Sorry, but it's not my panel. What do you feel about where history should start?
Well, I mean, I think that stuff that happened before you were born is part of the motivation for me in or why I think historical fiction as opposed to historical crime fiction just in general has an appeal is because it's trying to imagine what things were like before you were actually around and to try and enter into the sort of life, and that's kind of what I feel there's something of that going on, is just to sort of try and understand what the world was like before you were in it, really, in some ways. So I don't know, that's been part of my feeling. So, fascination about my parents' lives before, and then that generational thing I think is quite interesting, but that's not a sort of technical definition of
It's a moving frontier, isn't it, really? I have my grandfather fought in the Boer War, I have a photograph of him standing like this, and so I tend not to think of it as history, because I knew someone, dead now, but I knew someone who'd gone off and actually managed to come back with an Afrikaner wife. Now, quite how he managed that, I don't know. Her family never spoke to her again. I don't think of that as history, but of course I suppose it is. I think it's your own experience, really, that sets the barrier when you think history.
But there are books now being written in the 1950s, aren't there, that just as history.
I look upon it as my heyday.
So somebody wrote a book about the Vietnam War that is now 25, that's history. But if somebody wrote a book about the Vietnam War that was a Vietnam vet,
that's a memoir.
That's a memoir.
Yes, it depends really how he does it, I think. Any more questions? Yes.
Yeah, there is a Russian edition which came out last year. I haven't had my author copy yet, which that's something, that's one that I would like, yes. But no, it's A Gentle Axe did get translated into quite a few languages, sort of Estonian was one.
Yes.
I would like to have the Russian edition particularly, I think that would be, because it's almost like that's the original. So
do you speak Russian?
No. I don't know, I was the least qualified person to write the books that I did. It really came from having the idea and then having to find out everything that you needed to know to find the idea. And I didn't go to St. Petersburg before I wrote Gentle Axe. I did go after writing it and had the experience of almost having sort of imagined the place very sort of intensely, of being slightly finding it a slightly overwhelming experience, because it was almost like stepping into your own imagination and like, wow, it, although obviously the period was different, but the places felt like I thought they would have felt. So.
And you speak a lot of languages, don't you? And you're translated into a lot of...
I am translated into Russian. I have had a couple copies of the books, yes. It is quite an astonishing thing. You do quite wonder... In my case, it's the Mitchell and Markby books that have been translated into Russian and into Estonian and into Czech. And I do quite wonder what they make of it, and I asked, because I have just come back from Tallinn, and I said, what do they make of it all? And they love British crime, and they love on the TV Midsummer Murders and Heartbeat they watch, and they said, we are fascinated by all these beautiful quiet villages where there are so many murders. And
Andrew, have you been translated?
My books are published in America, but that's all. The Blackpool High Flyer, my second book, was translated into Italian. What the Italians made of, it's called something like Per Espresso.
Do you have to translate them into American for America?
They don't ask me any questions about the language. A review of one of them said, the narrated by the central character is from the north, It said, the Cockney narration is occasionally challenged.
What does that mean, actually?
Yes.
Is it difficult to switch periods once you've immersed yourself in one particular period? If you were to write another series, is it difficult to change gears and go to yet another period?
I have started a new modern series because I didn't particularly want to move into the past and stay there, so I have actually also started a new modern series as well, so hopefully they will run in tandem.
Also a crime series?
Yes,
yes. And it's called?
Well, the first one comes out next month, and it's called Mud, Muck, and Dead Things.
It's about funny life, right?
No, it's funny because I wrote 15 of the Mitchell and Markby stories, and then I really felt I couldn't take the characters forward anymore. And so I stopped it, and people kept saying, will you write another one? And I kept saying, I can't. But I took a character from the last of them, where That Way Murder Lies. There's a young woman inspector, Jessica Campbell. So I took her out, and I gave her a series of her own. So that's what I did.
I'm afraid that we have reached time. I have a bag of books here for the most interesting question. I'm going to give them to Bill Gottfried.
Okay. Well, I want to get... thank you very much. Maybe someone else should get a chance.
Why don't we spread them around?
That individual one.
Why don't we... Yes. Yeah. Books to everyone who asked a question.
Okay, that's a good
one. And thank you all very much for coming, and I think I would like you to put your hands together and thank our panel very, very much.